So the hope, the naive hope of this talk is it's going to make you all happy. Really happy. But partly the reason maybe it's naive, the hopeless hope, is I'm going to talk about suffering. But the purpose of talking about suffering is so we can be happy. So it would be nice if you came, left a little bit happier than when you came, so that I'm not, you know, wasting my efforts here. So I don't know. If I can do it. But, so 3 weeks ago, I gave a talk here on impermanence. And I talked about impermanence, which is from the point of view of what's called the three characteristics. And these are very central teachings of Buddhism. And more important than teachings, they are central insights that give insight meditation its name. So we say, we call ourselves Insight Meditation Center. And people are often asking, well, what's the insights? I don't have any insights yet. What are the insights about? And some people say, aha, I got an insight. The reason why I always say X is because my parents said Y to me when I was a kid. And now that, you know, biographical insight, psychological insight, we're kind of psychotherapeutic culture. So people often think that's what insight is. The insight of insight meditation has to do with seeing clearly. So it's not understanding per se, it's not intellectual understanding, but rather it's some capacity of using our perceptions to perceive directly how things are, as opposed to how we think they are. And so the three primary characteristics of our moment-to-moment experience that we can see, if we can see clearly, is that in some way or other it's impermanent. In some way or other it is suffering. It might not be a good word here. The word in Pali is dukkha, but for now we'll call it suffering. And in some way or other our experience is not self. So how does that work? It's counterintuitive to some degree. The Buddha called the way most people think topsy-turvy. And it's topsy-turvy because people take what is impermanent to be permanent. They take what is suffering as being a form of happiness. And they take what is not self as self. So they have it all mixed up. We have it all mixed up. And so part of what the insight meditation practice is trying to do is to take our understanding and put it right side up again so we can see more clearly how things actually are. For some people, that's topsy-turvy. I don't know, this just occurs to me. You know, I've read many times that I'm seeing you all upside down. I don't know about it, you know, somehow I think you're right side up, right? Somehow my brain understands it that way, but the way that the light kind of crosses inside the eyes and, you know, goes against the back of the retina, you're all upside down, thank you. Topsy-turvy. So part of the function then of mindfulness is to help right the perception so we can see how things are. But not for the purposes of only seeing how things are, but more importantly, for the purpose of beginning to loosen up the way the mind, the heart, is constricted or contracted or tight or holding on, clenched, or resisting, aversive, defensive. The mind, sometimes we call it the heart, will often find itself in a mood or an attitude. It's very deeply seated of somehow or other being attached or pushing away. And in fact, most people's minds, most of the time, are characterized subtly or grossly by those movements of pushing or holding. What does it take to get the mind to stop pushing or holding so the mind can be free, open, relaxed, at peace? It turns out that it might be relatively easy for some people to go on vacation or have a day off from work and feel a certain level of calm and relaxation and peace. But if you went on vacation for 365 days, pretty soon your decompression, your relaxation from your busy life would settle out, and you would discover that the peace that you experienced the first day of your vacation was not as peaceful as the mind can get. In fact, you might see that actually you don't have access to further peace. At some point you realize, you know, oh, there's a degree of anxiety, there's a degree of fear, there's a degree of drivenness in the mind, that I did, you know, that even there, when I'm actually been on vacation for 300 days, I just kind of relax, don't have to do a lot. So it can be very deep, the way the mind is conditioned itself to be attached, to be cling, to be tight, contracted. So you need very powerful medicine to get down into what's called the roots of the mind to help the mind loosen up, lighten up, get free. So the insight into the three characteristics is offered as medicine for that purpose. Is if you can see into the nature of reality, see into the nature of our experience very clearly, that's one very powerful way to begin loosening up the grip of the mind. And the reason why we need strong medicine is it's very hard on our own, through our own volition and choice, to just let go and relax, just like at that deepest level possible. And so we need something besides our own efforts. And one of the things that Buddhism suggests is it's seeing things as they actually are, which will help. It's that seeing. It's somewhat maybe of a, you know, parallel kind of statement to, well, I guess it's Jesus who said, the truth will set you free. So when you can see clearly what is, that somehow sets us free. So topsy-turvy. One of the starting points to explore suffering, this understanding of suffering, is to begin understanding it, see how it works in your life, that this is true. How is it in your life that you've mistaken what is suffering for happiness, seen as being happy? Or another way that the Buddhist tradition translates the word dukkha, sees what is unsatisfactory as satisfactory, sees as unreliable what is reliable. How have you done that? And probably all of you have done it to some degree. I see it's very clear in children. My 7-year-old, he can be absolutely convinced about what's going to make him happy. And right now it's baseball cards. And he had this idea a few weeks ago that he has something like 360 baseball cards. He knows the exact number. And he had some idea that he was going to reorganize all the cards in some new way in his little folder book that he has. So he thought he'd be a lot happier. So he took all the cards out. And they're really fast to take 360 cards out. But for a 7-year-old to organize them again and put them back in, it still hasn't happened. In fact, my desk at home is covered with baseball cards. And I tell him, you know, you got to do something because I need my desk back. So I don't know if that was a good example, but you see it in kids where they have some, you know, they see that clearly they have some idea, this is what's going to make me happy. Remember when I was a kid, maybe about his age, a little bit older, slightly older. I really wanted, I remember a lot of things now, but I really wanted, but I remember wanting this toy machine gun, plastic toy, kind of life-size machine gun, the kind of things, you know, my kid doesn't even know exists. And I thought, that's, you know, really wanted this machine gun. So I guess I wanted it so badly that my parents bought it to me, and I got it for Christmas. I don't think I ever played with it. You know, the allure, the promise of that toy machine gun was empty. It didn't really live up. It was that I thought it was going to make me happy, but getting it didn't really do much at all. When I've seen sometimes that certain activities, I can be somehow mesmerized by the promise of happiness, maybe even by some degree of happiness and joy in doing the activity. But if I step back, I realize that actually the activity I'm involved in is really uncomfortable, really miserable. One example comes to mind is, maybe that's not a good example again, is if I really want something, engage in some activity, trying to get accomplish something, get something done, and I'm driven to get it done, and I'm not paying attention, then I'm driven going along, and then something prompts me to pay attention to what's going on, and I realize, wait a minute, I am really uncomfortable. My body's tense, my shoulders are tense, my stomach is tight, my mind is kind of contracted and getting a headache, because I'm so involved in trying to do. And so the promise of getting something that I want and being engaged in trying to get it sometimes can mask the discomfort of the engagement. Does that make sense what I said? So that's another way in which the kind of thinking, understanding is upside down. If we step back and pay attention to what's going on while we're doing it, sometimes we'll do the cost-benefit analysis. And we'll say, this is not worth it. What I'm trying to accomplish here is simply not worth it. And I think there's a lot of people I've talked to in the tech world in Silicon Valley who at some point have decided, this is not worth it anymore. You know, they can do the cost-benefit analysis and somehow, you know, maybe it depends a little bit how much money's in their bank, but they do the analysis and they say, this is not worth it anymore. And they're ready to do something else. And so topsy-turvy. So one way of understanding topsy-turvy is we take what is unhappy, what is suffering, for being happy. The word is dukkha, and the dukkha is a multivalent word. It has a lot of meanings in the original language. So it's usually translated into English as suffering. In the Four Noble Truths, also another key teachings of Buddhism, it's fair to call it maybe translated as suffering. But as one of the three characteristics, the characteristic of dukkha, some people prefer to translate it as unsatisfactory or unreliable. That things are ultimately unsatisfactory or unreliable to provide lasting happiness or to provide lasting identity. This is who I am. And so is this movement of the mind to create ultimacy. This is going to do it once and for all. If I can just get this relationship, if I can get it, if I just go on this retreat, it'll do it. If I can go, you know, this is going to do it for me. And part of the insights of it is that actually, nothing will do it for you. There's no thing out there which is reliable, can provide ultimate reliability, ultimate satisfaction. So when we start realizing out there, no thing will do it, then what some people do is they look in here. Well, certainly if out there there's nothing, then let's look in here. And my heart's supposed to be great, right? Beautiful heart, or the wonderful psyche, or the brain, or I'll find something. the Buddha nature. This Buddha's talking about Buddha nature. I'll just sit quietly and find the Buddha nature. That's reliable, isn't it? And when you do insight meditation and develop a very keen ability to see what's happening in the present moment, you also find, even though there's a lot of beauty in here, that nothing inside also, no thing inside, also can provide lasting happiness, can provide reliable place to rest, can provide a ultimate satisfaction. No thing in here. So what's left? And what's left is for the mind, the awareness, to becoming slowly dissuaded from searching, from grasping. Grasping for things outside or grasping for things inside. And as the mind stops grasping, that's a nice image. You see, what you see, it stops grasping, right? The outside and inside. Then it's like a butterfly and it flies away. And so what becomes reliable is not a thing. It's not something you can point to, there it is. But rather what's reliable is that awareness of the mind which is not holding on, not clinging to anything. And it's very hard to make that into a thing. And it can be very hard for most people to believe that something which is not a thing has any value. Because it's things that have value. The house, the job, the relationship, the bank account, the whatever. My safety, or my good looks, my good smarts, my good kindness, my wonderfulness and something inside. To be convinced none of that is worth holding on to, because there's something of greater value. And what's of greater value is in a certain kind of way invisible. It has no monetary value. You can't see it. But it's experienced as a kind of ease or a kind of peacefulness or a kind of lightness or clarity or sense of openness or spaciousness or a certain kind of joy or happiness. The happiness of a mind which doesn't cling or hold. The happiness of a mind that doesn't need anything. The happiness of a heart that, or mind or heart, which is at rest in itself without that place, without it being a place. The mind is not a place. You can't rest in it. So the mind that's resting in itself, it's, where is it resting? So one of the ways that insight meditation then functions is as we begin looking carefully at our experience, we start seeing, oh, this here, what I took as being reliable, what I took as being satisfactory, what I took as being a form of happiness, doesn't really qualify either as that, or immediately, or in the long term. Doesn't provide lasting and long-term happiness. So to see that in the experience, not to be convinced, not to hear this as a kind of teaching, no thing is reliable, no thing is going to provide lasting satisfaction. I don't think hearing it is going to do you much good. But actually begin to see, this doesn't do it. So for example, to see very clearly that clinging to self-image is not going to be very helpful. Doesn't provide real happiness. We think it's going to provide happiness. Oh, if people can only see me. I put on a blue shirt today to come down here, If I can imagine looking in the mirror and wondering, blue shirt, but I bet they think blue is nice. It goes well with my eyes, I've been told. you know, they'll probably, you know, think much better of me. And hopefully they won't see I just, you know, I have to hide the fact that I have a hole in my sock. And so you can get caught up in the world of self-image, and somehow, subconsciously, my happiness is tied to how I think you see me. How I impress you will make me happy. But if you really can see clearly what the mind is doing, really deeply, see, it actually is not going to provide lasting happiness, and there's an alternative that's much better. There's an alternative happiness and well-being that comes when the mind can learn not to be neurotically concerned about self-image or be seeing the scene a certain way. So the mind which is not caught up in the world is a mind which is free. So in the world, not of the world. So the ignorance is a really important part of Buddhist practice. Buddhist teaching is that the teaching that people are ignorant. The primary thing that people are ignorant about is they're ignorant about the three characteristics. And if they penetrate or overcome this ignorance, that is one of the things that liberates us. It's that important, this particular teaching for Buddhism. So as we sit and meditate, a lot of the things that people associate meditation with, like becoming calm, reducing stress, getting concentrated, those are considered to be tools, sharpening tools that sharpen our ability to see more and more clearly. It's like you have a microscope and it's all dusty. So you have to clean the dust off the lens. And only then can you see clearly. Only when the mind becomes calm and still enough, when the dust of the mind is settled, can we see clearly into what this is called the three characteristics. And then, you might realize something. There was a monk in Thailand. I think he might have been an American or Englishman who first was a Zen monk in Japan for many years. And then he went in Thailand, became a monk there. And he lived in a cave for many, many years, practicing away, as monks sometimes do in Thailand. And eventually he died. I think he died in his cave. His cave was his home. He died there. He's an old man. And after he died, they went up to his cave to see what was there. And they found written on the wall of the painting on the wall in his cave was monastic graffiti. And there was a cartoon drawing of a Buddhist monk kind of jumping up in the air, kind of kicking his heels, kind of arms up, kind of like really happy. And then above was the caption, Oh, what boundless joy to know there is no true happiness. So why don't you think about that? Just that expression. Why don't you grapple with it? Take it as a koan for the next week. Talk to your friends about it. Try to explore all the different ways in which that might be true and how it works. How can that be? Oh, what boundless joy that there is no true happiness. So, did I make you happier? Well. We have some time if you have any questions or comments you'd like to make. Testimonials about suffering. Yes. Oh, yeah, please. Right behind you there.
So this is very pertinent, this talk for Mike and I. We met with a real estate agent today to talk about the specifications of the house we want to buy that will make us happy. And I'm struggling with how to approach this crazy process, and without getting really, you know, oh, I fall in love with this house, and oh, this has got to be the one, and all this stuff. And you know, I was thinking of a story you told when we were in Palo Alto. You were hunting for a car. You said that, you know, every time you'd get, oh, that's the car I want. No, it's the right color. No, people will like me and all this. Then you'd stop looking for the car until you weren't grasping for it. And that's a little hard to do with real estate, you know. And I'm trying to figure out how to approach this with something that has to happen so fast, and you know, we've got to be making these decisions, and if we don't think about what's going to make us happy, we'll end up in something that will be wrong, you know, for us. And how do we hold this?
That's a great topic. So I think that you should spend a couple of years thinking about what makes you happy.
And spend $400,000 more, yes.
Really consider what it's all about. But the I think it's very, very valid to think about what brings you a sense of well-being, what makes you happy. I mean, underlying all this, hopefully, is what is really important for you, what's most important for you. And I mean, there can be things about a house that can make you happy. It could have a beautiful view, for example, or it could have a beautiful, you know, something or other, right? And a really big house would make you feel really spacious and relaxed all the time, or one that had big veranda with opening doors and you feel the cool breeze coming in would make you certainly sit there and, you know, and sit there and have your Calistoga in the evening. There's a lot of things that can bring pleasure, and pleasure can bring a certain kind of sense of well-being. One of the questions, though, is is that really of enough value for you that you want to spend the time and the money for that, or are there other things that your time is better spent at? So, for example, it comes to mind. My father, when I was growing up, various times he owned a house. My parents. But after my parents separated, my father moved into a small apartment, and he's been living there now for 30 years, and he's very happy not to have to worry about the yard and repairs and, you know, all the things that kept him busy, because he has a lot of other things he'd rather do with his time, and he has certain passions for a lot of other things, so he's decided to reduce his attention to house and home, so he can follow the other things he's interested in. And so what's the trade-off? You know, what's most important for you? Maybe it's a more important question than what makes you happy. And if you're trying to ask what makes me happy in the house, there might be some things that make you happy. Maybe it's not worth it. Because it precludes the possibility of doing other things that make you a lot more happy, right? So, for example, if you buy a house for $400,000, that maybe it's a nice house and makes you happy. But if you can buy a house for $300,000 and spend $100,000 left over and use it for charity or use it for some good cause, you know, in 20, 30 years, you might reap so much more benefits from having donated that money to some wonderful charity, wonderful event, made something happen in the world, than just the fact that you're sitting in a nice house. And so, you know, what provides happiness? What's important to do? What's the important thing for who you are? So does that help at all?
With real estate around here, it's like, you know, you'd have to buy a trailer for $400,000 is the problem.
I saw advertised in the trailer park in Redwood City, $64,000.
A trailer?
Yeah, two bedroom.
You want a trailer, Mike?
Imagine what you can do. Imagine what you can do with the rest of the money. And you have this instant community. You know, a lot of people live in these communities. The house, they look at the house. But what's maybe more important is the neighborhood. You know, and so you know, the trailer parks sometimes have really great neighborhood. You know, all this community, and you get to know what's. You know, some people love it. Who knows? a good
but
luck.
It does give us food. It gives me food for thought.
Yeah, that's all I was hoping to do. I can't answer your question, but I could stir things up. Is that okay? Yes, please.
After reading the Metta Sutta and seeing how it ends with will not be reborn again, and all the activity that we get involved in to end suffering, what I'm wondering is, and believe me, I'm not contemplating this, but if you just committed suicide, you would be... you'd be done. You wouldn't have to deal with anything. It'd be all over.
But yeah.
And is that the reason why that the Buddhist philosophy must require the rebirth? Because otherwise you could commit suicide and there you'd be. I mean, you'd more or less reach the goal of nothingness. If there must be a rebirth in order to achieve it, then the suicide wouldn't work. I mean, is that the whole idea? That why there has to be a rebirth? Because otherwise, everything else kind of falls apart, doesn't it?
I can see the logic of what you're saying. I think in ancient India, when the teachings of rebirth arose, the horse was in front of the cart. I think they believed in rebirth first. And then they came up with the idea that it'd be nice to be free from the endless cycles. They didn't kind of, your logic kind of puts the horse in front of the cart. But if you don't believe in rebirth, then the important question then would be, if you don't believe in it, then why stay around? You know, if you're having a hard time, things are difficult. And that becomes very acute, that question, for some people. When there's people are really sick, and the question of euthanasia comes up, or assisted suicide, or something, at what point does that become a valid option, or where's the line that we draw when we decide? I believe that there are other motivations to avoid suicide besides the idea of rebirth. Maybe other people have better arguments, better understandings than mine, but my understanding is this, that if we have cultivated enough sensitivity, we'll realize two things. One, we'll realize the tremendous impact our suicide can have on others. And I've seen over and over again people committed suicide and how amazingly devastating it was for people around. If they had any inkling of what was going to happen in their wake, they wouldn't have done it, I'm pretty convinced. But they didn't know. They were kind of lost in their own world. So that was one. And the other sensitivity has to do with sensitivity externally, but the sensitivity is internally to our own working. I think that you'll always see that that the movement to commit suicide requires a very heightened degree of suffering in order to do it. Doing it itself is a form of suffering. And then doing it is such a suffering that it's actually worse than maybe the suffering you're living with. So I don't know if that's true, because I haven't been in that severe case as some people have been. But one of the arguments I'm making here is that sensitivity will show that that it's not the best route to go. Is that satisfying enough? Is this something you're contemplating? Yes.
I'm not contemplating suicide either. But it seemed like it took forever to memorize that Metta Sutta. And I have a friend of a friend who just found out that she's got lymphoma and maybe 50% chance of living, and you know, she started chemo, and it was so shocking to me, because here's someone my age who was fine and had night sweats, and then all of a sudden is, you know, really sick. And I like to think that saying the Metta Sutra will be helpful to someone in that situation, but is it?
So Metta Sutta is the Buddha's discourse on loving kindness. And in the Buddhist tradition, there's often emphasis on having, arousing a very powerful intention for loving kindness for other people. And there's this discourse called the Discourse on Loving Kindness, which is sometimes used as a form of protection. In different schools of Buddhism, different kind of chants or different liturgy are used to help people get better or be safe or to kind of have some kind of intention, some kind of effect on the world around us. So the question is, how do these things work? My understanding is that the Buddhist tradition, at least the early Buddhist tradition, says that yes, these things can have an effect, but the vehicle for that effect is not the words or even the meaning of the words so much as the intention behind them or the intention behind our speaking them. So when we chant the Metta Sutta, we infuse it with our intention, and it's been infused with other people's intention. And that intention somehow has a channel that operates in the universe, in the world. And maybe it's just kind of, you know, billiards. It kind of goes through all the people that we meet. The fact that, you know, if your friend hears and learns that you're chanting the Metta Sutra for her, it isn't the words that count, the fact that someone cares that counts. And that makes a big difference. So it's the intentionality, the motivation that carries the power. And it can be tremendous power in motivation or intention. And so in that sense, I believe it has a big effect.
When my first husband, was told he had 3 weeks to live, and he was going to a conference as a keynote speaker, the next day, he decided that he wouldn't take chemo, he wouldn't do anything. He would just prepare for his death. And it was my son who said, you know, you're a fighter, you've always been a fighter. And getting back to, you know, what you were saying, my husband decided to fight for his life more out of love for his son. But it became, in the year that he lived, beyond that 3 week death sentence, a kind of coming to terms with himself and love of himself. So I see that Metta Sutra work in wondrous ways.
For someone who has a spiritual practice, the time of dying or the time of crisis can be seen as a great opportunity. And if someone has some intuitive sense of the degree of freedom or peace that's possible, some people will decide to hang in there in order to find that resolution or find that you know, work through what needs to be worked through. And if you shortchange that process, then sometimes you shortchange the possibility of resolution or freedom that can happen. But what happens when the chemotherapy is so bad, the results of it are so terrible, that you don't have the ability to actually engage in the practice anymore? And that's where it becomes an article of faith. Some Buddhists will say, you never know what's possible. You never know what's going to happen. You try to stay conscious as long as you can, because there's always an opportunity for freedom. So I think some people, some Buddhist practitioners, are very inspired by what's possible. And so no matter how great the challenge they have in their life, their inspiration for what's possible carries them or keeps them alive to do the work that can be done. So it sounds like your husband did some of that work. Back up there. You want to say something, or you changed your mind? Last one, and I'll quit.
One of the things I was thinking about, going back to the nothingness comment.
Going back to what?
Going back to the comment about nothingness.
Yes.
And where that comes from. I spent a long time in my study of Buddhism trying to understand it in an intellectual sense, and I think that if you just rely on that, you can find yourself wandering down this kind of a dark alley of nihilism quite easily, and then the logic, you just can't figure it out. It's not something you can think about and understand. So when I decided just to practice more and think less, that's what really helped, you know, because then you understand that Buddhism, if you read it the wrong way, it starts to sound very dark, and you can really put a lot into it that's not there. It makes it sound very, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, good. Anyway.
Well, certainly Buddhism has been misunderstood in the West quite a bit, and that's one of the ways it's been misunderstood, that it's a nihilistic religion and life-denying, and it's all about kind of attaining some kind of nothingness. And that's not the case at all. So, the purpose of appreciating suffering is so we can lighten up and be happier. So may the two go together. Thank you.